Before we get to today's show, I want to mention that this episode is brought to you by our partners at EduTech. EduTech is Australia's largest educational festival and returns to Melbourne on the 24th and 25th of August. With over 450 inspiring speakers, captivating keynotes, engaging workshops, enlightening panels, immersive breakout sessions, and 400 market leaders on the expo floor, this is an experience you won't want to miss. And yes, Ed Leaders will be there, so you can come by and say g'day to us too. Register now with code EDLEADERS30 for an extra 30% off your ticket. Visit edutech.net.au for more details. All right, welcome to Ed Leaders, the podcast covering all the interesting ideas about leadership, strategy, culture, and the business of K-12 education, and where we believe with better leaders, we'll make better schools. I'm your host, Luke Callier, and today it's just me, no Matt. He's had something come up at the last minute, and I'm excited because that means I get to ask all the questions. But before we get started, if you haven't already, you should sign up for the weekly email sent out by the team at Ed Leaders. It's filled with interesting insights to help you level up your school leadership game. You can sign up to the newsletter at edleaders.com.au. Now on to today's guest, Enterprise Professor Sandra Milligan. Sandra is the director and lead of the new metrics program, or Melbourne Assessment, as it's now known, at the Melbourne Graduate School of Education. She's also started and sold multiple companies, so has some entrepreneurial flair, and has been a board of director of multiple organisations, and is back right now where she started her career here in sunny Perth, live in the studio, and she's taken in some time out of her day, spending some time with family here in Perth, to join us. So without further ado, let's get to it. Sandra, welcome to the show.
Hi, Luke. Thanks. It's great to be here.
Excellent. Now, we love to start the conversation with a bit of that, your journey in education. And as I mentioned just then, I know that you started your journey here in Perth. Maybe you could talk through what you did in those early days and how that progressed through your career.
Started at UWA doing maths and science, taught for a few years here in Perth as a maths and science teacher. And then I got dragooned into the education department, where I had a decade or so as a researcher, which was in those days, education departments had their own researchers. It was amazing. And then I did a tour as superintendent of Equal Opportunity. We used to have superintendents in those days, and then director of curriculum. And after that, that's when I got stuck into my entrepreneurial career for a couple of decades. But that's where I started, right slap bang in the middle of education in Perth.
And so what sort of research were you doing as a researcher for the department at that time?
Well, I'm very quantitative, the maths and so forth, and assessment and measurement. So basically I was involved in evaluating programs, trying to figure out whether kids were actually learning anything. We were one of the first states that, I shouldn't confess this, that assessed literacy and numeracy on a systemic basis. That was all terribly surprising because we found some kids couldn't read, which was pretty amazing. So we were doing those kinds of things, the sorts of things that now are done in ACARA or in the authorities or in the universities. It was all done in the education departments in those days.
And when you talk superintendent, I have this vision of the superintendent or like the warden coming around and telling people what they should and shouldn't be doing. What did that role kind of look like back then?
Well, I was really young and female in a bunch of older men, and I was the superintendent of Equal Opportunity, and you can probably guess what that meant. It meant that I was pretty unusual. And really what it involved was encouraging people to think about what they were doing. In those days, a really key issue was the girls didn't do maths hardly at all, and boys didn't do much of the humanities. So part of it was just going around and saying, why do you think that might be? And do you think there might be any girls who might be good at maths and like it, and the other side for the boys? So it was really encouraging people to interrogate their views and their school policies. So, it was a leadership role for principals, I think, in particular.
And from there, director of curriculum, I think you said. Obviously, during that journey, you took on multiple roles there. Did you have someone within the department that was, you know, like a mentor or was looking out and kind of saying you should apply for these roles? What did that look like at the time?
I've had through my life a number of really brilliant mentors, male and female, and I'm forever grateful to them. At that time, when I was really young in the department, I really looked up to the Director General of the time, a guy called Dave Mossenson, who had a very expansive view about what government schooling could do. And I did and I still do take a lot from him. Then I had people in the university and in the department, senior officers who really mentored me and helped me along, and I really needed it. women like Anne-Marie Heine and Nairi Young and so forth. It's like it's sort of small and friendly and everyone knows everyone. So it was a lovely time for me, very supportive, and I learned heaps.
And so what drove you then? You obviously, you know, were enjoying your career, you had some career progression, but then, you know, took that step out and you kind of followed a little bit of an entrepreneurship journey for a little while.
Yeah. It's hard to say. When I look back over my career, I think there has been one constant, and that is I really love change. And
change for yourself and change for others?
For myself, but change for the world. I really still hate it when I see kids who aren't enjoying school. And I really hate it when I see those gap statistics about various groups in our schools where some kids get left behind. And I just don't think it's necessary. So I always, I think all my life I've been searching to get this sort of perfect situation for all the kids. And I know that sounds a bit silly, but I think that's what's driven me all the time. When I was in equal opportunity, I desperately wanted girls and boys to have equal opportunities. The first business we ran was called the Good Universities Guides. And what we really wanted was to get kids to understand that getting a high ATAR and getting into the top university wasn't the best thing. You should go to where you want to go and what's best for you. So it was a sort of a matching thing. And now with new metrics, what we're trying to do is get everyone with the skills and abilities they need to leave school. So I think that's been a constant for me, always trying to do the next best thing, whatever that is, and it's fun.
Yeah, we like to kind of consider that as kind of impact, I guess, at EdLeaders, and trying to, I guess, maximise the impact that you can have both, you know, like within your own kind of connection groups, but also I think at a larger level. Does that kind of resonate?
Yeah, I think impact is probably a really good word. I hadn't thought about it like that before. But we all want to make impact, I guess. I mean, that's why most of us go into teaching, I guess. And I got a taste for system level impact and the impact of an idea. I mean, that's a really powerful thing. You can just drop an idea into a pond of people and you can see the ripples. So I quite like the idea of impact. So thank you for that.
Yeah, and I think what you're kind of describing there is that scale up of impact over time. Like, you know, initially it's in your own classroom, in your own school, then systemic at a kind of state level. And I'd probably say now at a national level, which is, you know, quite an impressive journey to go on, and not something that most people can do, and we'll come to new metrics in a minute. But I guess I'm interested in, you know, going back to that conversation around the good universities guide and that notion of, like, you don't have to all get, like, the top mark to get to the best course. My sense is that that's still the case sometimes. Like, I still have that conversation here on a regular basis. I know Matt would too, that you want students to just choose the subjects they're interested in, not the subjects to get the highest mark possible. So do you think it's changed since you were kind of, you know, at the start of that journey with the Good Universities Guide?
Yeah, I think it's changed, but I also think it's got a fair way to go. I mean, you still hear kids and parents talking about kids not wasting their marks. Don't waste your marks. Look, you got 98. You may as well go into this course because that's got a high cutoff. But so there is all of that. But I think students these days are more canny and they know what they want more, particularly the ones who are graduating around now. I remember a young woman, yeah, who was just graduating from school last year that I spoke to, and she was the first one who I heard say, "I am more than my ATAR." And that really resonated with me. And those young people who are dropping out of HSC, VCE, WACE, they're saying, "No, that's not for me. I am really ambitious, but I'm ambitious for something else." So I feel as though there is an awakening now. I think things are much better than it was 20 years ago, but I think they're going to get better even more.
Yeah, let's hope so. I think, what you've described there also, the listeners will know this because I've described it before, but, that was me, like I had a, good ATAR and I wanted to get into education, and someone at the school I was at actually said, no, don't waste your ATAR. Don't waste it on that. Go and do engineering. And I don't regret that decision because I'm still here where I was supposed to be most likely. But, I do think it was a common story and still is in a lot of schools where parents expect, if they're paying for a certain level of education, then they're going to get a certain number and that's going to relate to a certain career. And it just, I think, more and more doesn't necessarily work like that. And I kind of think students are more and more cottoning onto that as they kind of get more, I guess, savvy with the system.
Yeah, I think that's true. I was just talking this morning with some senior people who were trying to think about what policies should be put into place over the next few years. And one of them asked me, what do you think we should do as an education system? And should we...
Isn't that a nice question to be asked?
No, not really. Yeah. I often wonder if they really want to know.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Things like should we have more NAPLAN or should we make maths compulsory or... all of these sorts of things are in play. And when I think about it, when I think of the young people we talk to through the range of projects we're in, what do they really want? They want to feel competent, right? And you can be in a position of not feeling competent no matter what your scores are. So you want competence. And I mean competence, not just mastery of the course. So competence. Connectedness. They want to know who they are, who their community is, who their culture is, who do they belong to, what do they belong to. So competence and connectedness. They want a sense of being able to be in charge of themselves. They want agency in their learning, and that's really important. So if you're shooting, they also, I think, want to feel that they're on top of something, so they want depth in something. They don't just want to skim across the surface and, get 75% in a number of tests that they will tomorrow have forgotten what they said. So if you want kids and if students want those things, then we'd have to really rethink particularly the structure of senior secondary, because the structure of senior secondary is mostly all about mastery of set content. So if you want connectedness, competence, agency, and depth, we really need to rethink. Now, that's new metrics.
So probably, a good segue there. Now, I assume that most of the audience know a little bit about new metrics, but that, might be an assumption, and you know what assumptions are like. So you've kind of described a little bit there around new metrics. But perhaps you could go into a bit of more of detail around new metrics and kind of maybe what it's aiming to do, and maybe the origin story might be interesting, to how it kind of came about.
Yeah. Honestly, it started probably about 12 years ago with special ed kids who were working at below foundation level. And the Assessment Research Centre, which is now Melbourne Assessment, was working with the Education Department in Victoria. And the question was, what skills do these kids know to get to the point where they can operate in a normal classroom, right? And what that actually boils down to is things like confidence, competence, bit of agency in their own learning, a feeling that they're known as a person. And so we developed a range of assessments that teachers can use to find out if kids had the foundation skills to be able to operate in a classroom. Now, that was 12 years ago. We've now built that up to cover, if you like, the foundation learning skills of every child, often called the general capabilities in schools. So that's where it came from. How it developed was a number of principals and teachers came to us and said, look, we really want to develop all of these things, but we don't know if we're achieving it. How do you assess these things? Can you assess them? How can you tell the difference between a student who's done really well in getting on top of these skills and one who hasn't? And how can I help them? So that's where new metrics came from. So it's saying we want metrics to cover those kinds of foundational capabilities to complement the standard metrics that we've got of NAPLAN and PISA and literacy and numeracy and mastery of discipline content. So they're the old metrics. I'm not saying throw them out, but they are what we're good at. So we wanted to get good at new metrics that go to these deeper foundational general capabilities and skills that provide the basis for all learning.
And what does that look like, I guess, scientifically speaking and kind of from an academic point of view, a research point of view, what does that look like in terms of how much data you need to gather in order to like put some verification behind that measurement? What does that look like?
Well, if we can go back a step before I get to the question of data, the first thing that we've found is necessary is getting everyone, by everyone I mean the students, the teachers, the parents, to understand what these things are. Like, if I can give you an example, if you take something like collaboration, so that's a really good one. Everyone wants everyone to be able to collaborate. Well, what do we mean by collaboration? So the first thing that we have developed is talking with hundreds, perhaps thousands of teachers and students, is an idea of what collaboration looks like for the novice, for the person who's developing, for the expert, and for the really brilliant collaborator. What does that look like in terms of the behaviour of students? What do you need to notice before you can tell whether you've got a student who's really good at collaboration or not? We call these progressions, and we've developed with our new metric schools and others progressions for around about 52 competencies that are of general interest in schools. Now, for instance, a collaboration one, they don't have to be, they're very commonsensical. And I know common sense is sometimes considered not very good.
But not very common.
not very common or too common or something. Yeah. But, you know, if you take collaboration, you only need four or five levels to be able to understand the practical significance of different skills. Like at the very lowest level, a collaborator might just do as they're told when they're in a group. So they're collaborative in the sense that they do as they're told. At a more middle level, maybe one or two levels up, you'll get the student who really feels part of the group and who does what they think is the right thing. That's a mid-level collaborator. At the top, you've got the student who is really in there assisting everyone else to achieve group goals and looking to what they can do, and that would be a top-level collaborator. Now, just getting teachers and students and everyone to understand what these levels are and how they manifest in a classroom, that's step one. That's even before you've even started assessing.
Yep.
That's getting it. Then you can go to how to assess it, which means helping teachers. We identify a whole pile of behaviours that relate to the different levels, and then we ask teachers, have you seen this behaviour? Yes, no. Have you seen that behaviour? Yes, no. Have you seen that behaviour? Yes, no. And by building up that profiles of yeses and noes on the behaviour of the student, we can very accurately point them at a level, and that's assessment.
Now, I've got two things, and I'm glad you brought up collaboration because I often talk about this in a high school setting. I wonder if you have any thoughts on the notion of, you know, like collaborative skills, and generally, you know, most employers and teachers say we want kids to be good collaborators, and the fact that it's one of your capabilities, you know, attests to that. But we often get to year 11 and 12 and maybe even in year 9 and 10, and most of the academic subjects have zero collaborative work involved in them. And I think it's such a disservice because it's so siloed to individual work so that they can get their individual assessment, individual grade, and there's not a lot of room for, potentially not a lot of room for group dynamics and group work in those projects or in those assessments that they're the way they're currently done in most schools. But then they get to university and straight away, you know, first semester, first year, they're in group assignments and they're like, hang on a second, what's this about? Group assignments, like, oh, I'm going to leave that to all the others because I've never actually had to work in a group for the last 3 years. Last time I did a group project was in year eight. That's one thing. That's one question for you. And the second question I'd probably have as well, something that Matt and I would often talk about when it comes to these kind of progressions, is I often wonder whether teachers take the time to understand what level of the progression they're at, because not all staff are at mastery in all of these domains. And so I guess two questions there. Any thoughts or comments on either one?
Yeah. Go first to the question of whether or not students get an opportunity to collaborate or even an opportunity to learn how to collaborate. And the answer is obviously, you've said it yourself, no, sometimes they don't. And if a student is doing a highly academic program focused on the ATAR, almost by definition, they're not going to learn these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I'd have to say that's one of the main motivations of principals and senior leaders who join up with our work, because they're saying, well, what we actually need to do is shift the culture of teaching and learning. We call it the learning design, so that every student, no matter what their domains of study, like, you know, maybe someone's interested in physics, chem and two maths, maybe someone's interested in becoming a plumber, maybe someone's interested in becoming a childcare worker, doesn't matter. They do need to get across some areas of content, but let's get to the point where everyone, no matter what they're learning, also has opportunities to develop these general life skills, you can call them. But to do that, the principals and school leaders understand that that's going to need some change, not necessarily to what's learned in the mainstream curriculum, but how it's learned. And they also want some metrics to show whether they're succeeding in that. So I think you put your finger on it, but that's one of the reasons why in new metrics our principals say this is about inventing a new grammar of schooling. Mm-hmm. Sure, we need the assessments, and that's where we come in at Melbourne. We can do the assessments, but for the school leaders, it's a much bigger issue. It's how do you change the grammar of the teaching and learning so that kids can get on top of their content but also develop these other skills.
Now, I'm going to contradict myself because I'm going to actually throw a different kind of sway at that as well, is that where I do see some of those skills really being developed is in the co-curricular programs. But again, you know, not always do you see some assessment done of what sort of collaborator they are in a, you know, in an ensemble or a sporting team. And, you know, not every school obviously has the co-curricular programs that go with it. But I do think that that lens of seeing a student across multiple domains is interesting, because just because they're a great collaborator on a football field does not mean that they'll be a great collaborator in a, you know, in a geography classroom. And I think we'll come back to this in a little bit about new metrics and how you need multiple points of view. But I guess, you know, have leaders and principals that you've been talking to describe similar to that, that they can see it happening, but they're not, you know, pulling those levers from where it is happening per se?
Yeah, so a couple of things there. Well, here, let me just make 3 points. First, when we first, one of our most popular assessments is agency in learning. So to what degree do students take responsibility and care and love in their own learning? So we have an assessment for that. And when in our new metric schools, when these assessments were first done, we said, well, you know, you're really going to need to get an assessor who really knows a student, because they won't be able to, unless they know the student, they won't be able to answer all of these behavioural questions. And in fact, we found that 26% of the responses were, I don't know. And that's because they'd only seen the students in a very narrow range of opportunity. Now, I at that point, I thought, oh, gosh, you know, what are principals and teachers going to say about that? And what they said is, this shows that we haven't got our structures right in the school, because we should know these things about students as learners. And therefore, this shows us how the directions in which our program can go. Now, the other thing we get told is, look, I'm the maths teacher. I've assessed this student's agency. They have none. They sit in the corner. They don't say boo to a goose, and they clearly are not engaged. And you'll get the history teacher saying, what? Are you talking about the same student? This is one of my most engaged students, et cetera. So what do we say about that? Well, first of all, that kid probably hates maths and loves history. So do we want to keep forcing them to do maths? Of course we do.
No, I'm agreeing with you.
Do you want them to go really deep into history?
Couldn't agree more.
Develop their quantitative skills through a bit of history. So in the new metrics approach, we say the important thing is not necessarily the subjects people students do, but their program. What does their program look like? And when you're assessing them, look at where they are the best they can be, and that's when you're getting a true measure of the capability of the student. And that is what they will deploy when they're really engaged in their life and wanting to thrive. So we're looking for their thrive potential, and we don't necessarily look at it in every classroom.
Yeah, I really love that concept, because I think kids can thrive in so many different areas that it doesn't have to be mathematics. You know, if it is, great, but why put all our kind of eggs into trying to measure it in that specific domain when quite clearly they're going to be really interested in that area over there?
But Luke, I've got really guilty now about all the maths teachers
out there. No, well, you know, you and I are back from a science and maths background, so we did it, you know, we're okay.
I'm going to change my examples at the time.
All right.
Because, you know, some kids really thrive in maths, some in history, some in phys ed. So maths teachers,
you know, but I do think that there, you know, like there are some kids that will thrive being on a sports field and won't thrive being in a classroom. There will be some kids that thrive in a workshop building things that won't thrive in other areas or on a, you know. So I think there is really something in measuring it where they're most thriving, and honouring that in the way we display it on a report, not hide it in the back of, you know, like a comment or, you know, in the back pages of a report that kind of say, oh, yeah, there's just a tick box that says that, oh, they did this particular activity. Just going back to that, I guess, the agency part of a student's journey, we had Vaughan Cleary on a little while ago, and he talked about the mind map, you know, experience that they've created at Assumption College and the amount of agency those students have. And you know, we've talked about that both here at my school and at Matt's school around the amount of agency in the subjects that students are able to have in kind of year 7, 8, 9, 10, and the percentage is a lot lower than in a place like Assumption College. I'm wondering whether you can describe kind of like the efforts you're seeing across the schools that are involved with New Metrics around providing more, you know, student agency and choice when it comes to what they're learning.
One thing I don't like talking about is student choice, because I don't think agency has got is manifest just through choice. So if you say, do you want to do this or that, and, you know, choose, and therefore you will be more committed to the this or the that, I don't think that works.
Okay.
I think agency has got to come from inside, where you're connecting to what it is that's important in the student's life. Now, how does that translate into schooling? What we're noticing is much more use of things like a subject turning into a project-based, where students can go really deep, including into things like calculus in year 9, because they actually want to figure out how to map change in something. Now, that's pretty powerful. They didn't say, oh, I want to do a project on calculus. They say, I want to do a project on this, and that happens to have change in it, so they go there. So project-based learning is really good. Work-embedded learning, you know, on internships or work experience, blocks, so that there are multidisciplinary approaches, so that students have option, you know, they can really get into something they really love. In Aboriginal communities on country, exploring things on country is a really way to find out, you know, what kids are really connected to and what their capabilities are. My favourite sort of example at the moment is with big picture schools, which have that particular school system has changed their whole learning design in years 11 and 12, so that students can develop agency hugely. And they don't do subjects. They don't, it's not timetabled. But every student has to do an autobiography, a thesis, an internship, a community program, and the depth that comes out of those studies is really phenomenal. Now, that's sort of an extreme end of the spectrum where they've changed the whole learning design. But we notice that schools that take on the agency issue really quickly start to re-examine the basic structures of their teaching and learning, and teachers become less experts and more facilitators, and that's a big shift.
If you love what we do here at EdLeaders, then please support us by supporting our sponsors. And as you heard at the top of the show, today's sponsor is EduTech. EduTech is one giant festival for all of education, and this year is happening on the 24th and 25th of August at the Melbourne Convention Exhibition Centre. Not only will you hear from an amazing lineup of speakers, including today's guest, you'll also be able to meet us there. Yes, that's right. EdLeaders is coming to Melbourne, and you'll be able to stop by and say g'day in the exhibition hall, featuring over 450 exhibitors, where you can see some of the latest and greatest from the world of technology and innovation. Aside from seeing us there, you can learn from some of the best educators around the globe with learning streams for school leaders, teachers, ICT managers, and digital technology, just to name a few. There are also boundless opportunities to hang out, network, make new connections, and exchange ideas. If there is one conference this year to level up your leadership game, this is it. Register now with code EDLEADERS30, that's EDLEADERS30, for 30% off your ticket. Visit edutech.net.au for details. And make sure you support us by stopping by and saying hello. Now let's get back to today's show. You know, I'm interested in, you talked there about big picture and kind of like the work they're doing at that end of the spectrum. Sometimes Matt and I describe education like nationally as like this, you know, massive behemoth of a Titanic that's, you know, 28 times the size of Titanic, and, you know, it takes years sometimes to course correct maybe a degree. What would have to happen, do you think, and what would, like, what could a journey look like if those types of programs became, you know, more widely accepted?
Look, I'm fairly, I've been around for a long time in education, right? That's probably the polite way of putting it. And when I was a young woman, the way to glory for education was strong central leadership from the departments and the governments and so forth. I think we're past that now, and that what we're looking for is communities of interest in schools building up responses to the particular needs in their community. Now, something that works in the outback is not going to be the same as something that works in the city. And the people who are best to understand that are the people in the outback and the city. So to me, big picture is something that has grown up in response to that, and it's a strong thing that's working for those schools that it works for. The new metrics schools are each building up a strong approach for their own constituency that will work. So I feel as though we've got to get a lot of this strength from the schools and the communities, and the role of government is in structuring something around that so that there is a common language and a common understanding and a sense of commonwealth around the community. So I don't think there is going to be one size fits all, Luke, is where I'm coming from. I think it's going to be quite diverse, and what we'll need is something, a lighter overlay than we perhaps currently have to hold it all together for the community. But I really think the solution is going to be from the schools up over the next few years.
Do you think, you know, in your conversations, do you think governments are wrestling, you know, with that decision around how much, you know, in inverted brackets for the audience out there, power, you know, they're wielding or controlling when it comes to education systems in their own states or nationally, and how open do you think they'll become as, you know, and I agree, you know, that nature of communities of interest and what's right, and I think principals understand this, what's right for my community in this moment in time is not necessarily what's right for the community, you know, on the other side of the river. You know, any thoughts on where government's at on that journey?
Well, I feel as though we are at a bit of an opportunity point, shall I say, because I'm not the only person, and nor are you, who's saying, hang on, our NAP plan's been flat for 20 years, we appear to be dropping in PISA, more kids are dropping out of school early than before. The equity gaps are getting worse. So there's a sense that if we keep on doing what we've been doing for the last 20 years, we'll keep getting the same response. So what's the different that we have to do? And I feel that there is that awareness. I mean, there's Minister Clare's panel, and there's almost every state's doing something, and there's a lot of discussion about. I imagine it will take a few years to work through, but I feel as though where governments are at, I can't speak on behalf of governments, but I have a sense that there is the idea around that we need to be thinking afresh, and that's step one.
Step one, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. I guess just something I wanted to ask you about when it comes to like testing results, and you mentioned a couple there, NAPLAN, PISA, you know, there's a bunch of others as well, whether that notion of them remaining flat is an indication of students at that point in time are capable of learning what they've learnt, and the curriculum, if you're at expected in curriculum, then you're at the expected level, and that level doesn't change over time. And if we were to see it go up, does it really just kind of indicate that, you know, a year seven is now learning what a year eight learnt 10 years ago? Is there anything you could kind of comment on when it comes to that national testing and what that really means in terms of those sorts of ideas?
Well, I believe the psychometricians, when they say these assessments are underpinned by stable standards, so that if we assess this cohort this year and the next cohort next year, we should be, if there's a difference, that does suggest that overall things are going up or down. Now, if we accept that, and I do, basically, then I think you have to be a bit pessimistic about what's happened, largely because we've been testing for 12 years or whatever, more, 15 years for NAPLAN and even more for PISA. And at best, we're flatlining. At worst, we're dropping. And we're spending so much money on it, so much money. So
on education or the testing?
And so you have to think, well, if we're spending all this money and we're not getting any change, perhaps we should change. Now, can I say one more thing about standardised testing?
Yeah.
I think it's probably looking at the wrong things. Like if you take a literacy test, it tests whether a student can say 2 plus 2 equals 4. And if it says no, the instinct is to say, I will tell them that 2 plus 2 is 4, and I will furthermore teach them that 3 plus 3 is 6. When what we actually know about things like basic literacy, numeracy, who can read, who can write, is that often it's not the technical skills that are the principal problem. It's a sense of self that I'm no good at maths, or I hate maths, or why are they teaching me this, or any one of a or I can't see any use for this, I'm not going to do this. So my feeling is that the standardised testing directs the gaze at one small part of what's required for students to become competent, and that is the technical skill. What we need is things that direct the gaze to the things that learning science tells us really matter, which is a sense of confidence, a sense of agency in learning, a sense of relevance and engagement, and all of those kinds of things. And now we've done a complete circle, Luke, back to where I began.
And so then my follow-up question to that would be, you know, of the 52 competencies that you kind of mentioned, how many of them will one day replace numeracy or literacy on a NAPLAN style? You know, I understand, you know, the assessment way of doing that is probably not possible, but, you know, I guess what you're saying is we're measuring the wrong things.
Yeah, I'm not saying we shouldn't measure whether kids can do 2 plus 2 is 4. You probably do. You do need to measure that. But one or two of our competencies in that 52, one is quantitative reasoning, which we've done for Big Picture, which goes far beyond whether you know that 2 plus 2 is 4. It goes to if you're in your life, do you get why you might need to know that 2 of these plus 2 of these is 4 of these? And if you lose half of them, that you've still got 2 left, and you can divide them into quarters and you've got 8, et cetera, et cetera. So it goes to the quantitative reasoning and the competence with numeracy that students need. So I would like to see something like that be a supplement or a replacement to something like NAPLAN, because I think it's more realistic and it's got more chance of getting kids connected. So, yeah, I'm not arguing that we shouldn't do standardised testing, right? But I think there's far too much emphasis on it.
Just to change the subject for a second, and we kind of get back to new metrics for a second. You know, one of the things I've heard you talk about on a YouTube clip or something like that is around understanding assessment and kind of what a teacher should be looking for, or why you might do an assessment. And I wonder whether you have any thoughts on, you know, how many teachers and leaders that you work with really understand the true kind of value of assessment and how they're designing it and why they're designing it in certain ways.
Oh, look, I'm a fan of teachers, right? So I think that after you've been teaching for 3 or 4 years, you know a whole pile of things about learning that is often not captured. So an experienced teacher, you'll see them walking around the room and they'll be watching what kids do and they'll be talking to kids and they'll be asking them pointy questions. And what they're doing in that, either explicitly or implicitly or tacitly, is really positioning that student in their conception of where they're up to in their learning. Now, to me, that is assessment. It is picking the behavioural indicators that point to where the student is in their learning journey. That is assessment. And I think most teachers get that. So if we can articulate the progression in an explicit sort of way, and with the competencies, what we do is we sit down with a whole pile of experienced teachers and we say, right, what does it look like when a kid's really good at it? What does it look like when they're developing? What does it look like when they're early in their journey? And teachers just go, there it is. It's like that. It's like that. It's like that. We gather it all together, put it in a nice set of boxes, zhuzh it up in terms of the language, and teachers say, yes, that's helpful, because we've fed back to them what the really good teachers implicitly know. And then once they get that, then picking the behavioural indicators is very natural. So it's a naturalistic way of doing it. With your standardised test, it's all out of teachers' hands. Totally out of teachers' hands. They don't know necessarily what the test was even looking at. So this is a much more naturalistic thing that goes with teachers' understanding of assessment.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, I think when you talk to teachers, they instinctively know who's doing well, who's in the middle, who needs some improvement, who's probably smarter than they are but are not really showing it. But they still like to kind of refer back to the test or, you know, the XYZ to just give them that backup and support. And I think sometimes it's about being able to answer a parent's question and being able to kind of have that backup to go, no, this is like, even though I've been in a classroom for 20 years and I know this kid knows this, I need to have this thing over here to verify that what I'm saying about this student is true. And so I guess I'm interested in, you know, like the journey that the schools that you've been working on have gone on with their parents. I'm wondering whether you could share, you know, any insights around, you know, a community's journey with their parents with new metrics.
Look, the first thing I would say is just back to the previous point you made. Teachers do like to get verification of what they think, and they are sometimes really surprised about particular students. So a good assessment does provide that feedback loop, and it does provide teachers with a lot of things to talk to parents about, particularly if you've got a good progression, because then you could have a very detailed discussion with the parent about what the student is able to do, and the parent gets it too. Oh, that's what you're talking about. In new metrics, our principals are acutely aware of the importance of having of being aligned to their community views. And that's a key topic all the time. And so what would I say about that? What I'd say is that parents are not just one thing. So there's usually, as there is in every staff room, a diversity of views in parents and in a parent body, and therefore very good principals navigate that brilliantly, as you know. So that would be the first thing I would say is evident. Different schools, some schools have a parent body who are totally committed to the ATAR, or a number of parents who are totally committed to the ATAR, and no one is saying to those parents, you can't have that. By the same token, most schools where we've been associated with the parent groups, there are always parents in the group who have the experience in their own workplace of the importance of things like collaboration and having agency and taking initiative and being persistent and all of those kinds of things. And so in any parent body, our experience is if you tell people what you're doing, they're there ahead of you in some respects because they're in the community as well and they know what's going on. So I would say you asked me to give you some examples. I think it would be great if you had some of the new metrics principles on and they can tell you. There have been some horror stories, but mainly the tide in the community is heading in this direction, and I think the principles are going with it.
And I think sometimes, like, either that's, you know, a brave principle or a principle that hasn't kind of, necessarily, I guess what am I trying to say there? I think it's a brave principle, or it's a principle that knows where the tide is going. And I think sometimes principles, can be worried about, like they may feel like they know where the tide is going and where it's going to shift to, but the journey of taking parents with them, can be hard and it can be tiresome, and the complexities of managing a school on a day-to-day basis by itself without change can be hard enough sometimes.
I'd have to say also our team's done a number of high-level consultation with peak employer groups and peak university groups and school peaks and so forth. And if I could characterise the quality of the feedback that we're getting those consultations, it is, of course, we've got to head in that direction. Employers are not saying, I want people who can read and write and sit up straight and do as they're told. They're saying, I want people who will lean in to what is to be done, who are collaborators, communicators, who take initiative and so forth. So all of the feedback we're getting from the community is supportive of this. I don't think it's kickback that's the problem. The problem is that things aren't going fast enough for these first mover principals and schools. They want more change. They want to be supported more by governments and employers and universities.
And parents, I expect as well. You mentioned something there in your answer, and I just kind of wanted to dive in a little bit. You mentioned the team at New Metrics. Sometimes people would see you as the lead of it and just go, it's all you. So maybe you could just kind of allude a little bit more around, the size of the team, the types of work that the team does, how that plays out.
Okay, so there are 18 of us, last count. Which for a university research centre is pretty big, but sometimes it feels really small. Now, who are we? We're a really interesting bunch. We've obviously got psychometricians because we're assessment and credentialing people. So they're people who can crunch numbers and things like that. We've got about 4 psychometricians. I used to be a psychometrician.
I've never actually heard that word before today, but I like it. A psychometrician, yeah.
Well, my psychometricians would say I'm not really a psychometrician anymore. I haven't been on the tools for a while, but that's someone who really knows whether an assessment is working okay or is it telling you the fibs about the person that's being assessed. We have philosophers. because a lot of this work has to do with what are the key qualities of being human that we want, and particularly in an AI world, we don't want to be producing little robots. We want to be producing wise people. So we've got two academics who have training in philosophy, and their input into our work is really valuable. So when you get psychometricians and philosophers together, that's really interesting. Cross-discipline.
Yeah.
We have teachers, because this is the craft and profession of teaching we're talking about. So we have a number of teachers and people who've been senior leaders in schools. Angela Pollock is actually the lead person in New Metrics, and she's a former deputy in a school. And we have policy, senior policy people, because we need work with governments as well. Then we have the people, the technologists, because you can't do this without technology. So we've got a small team of people who build beautiful platforms and tools that teachers can use, not to replace teachers, but because we're all about the humans, but to support the teachers in what they have to do, so it's as not as onerous as it might otherwise be. So that's our team. We're, you know, philosophers, psychometricians, teachers, technologists, and then people who make it all work, people who are good at organisations that make us all work together.
And how does your role specifically fit into that group of people? Obviously, you know, one part of our podcast is leadership, and it sounds like quite an interesting group of people to kind of work with on a day-to-day basis. You know, can you talk about kind of what that's like leading that group of people for you?
It is a delight and a privilege, I have to say. I really love a good argument. I really like to feel as though what you're doing is well-founded and is respectable and robust. This is the psychometrician in me coming through. And it is such a pleasure to work with a diverse group like that, who have come together, and we're a very stable team. Most of us have been working together for at least 6 or 8 years.
Obviously like each other then, that's a good sign.
Oh, did I say that?
Yeah.
I think we all respect each other. We all have passions of some description. The philosophers are passionate philosophers. The psychometricians are passionate psychometricians. And it comes together with our schools to have, you said it at the beginning, impact. So I feel as though we're all addicted to really positive impact, and that's what holds it together. My role, I don't, I can't really say. You probably have to ask other people, but I just love what we're doing and feel that it's my job to get people to be doing the best they can that they want to do, and that's sort of my role.
And if I could ask it in a different way, but you also mentioned earlier that you have a range of projects that you've kind of been kind of working on. What is a day in the week of, you know, your working life on a normal day look like?
I don't know how to answer that. I get up pretty early in the morning and I do all my thinking time for the first 2 or 3 or 4 hours. Because there's a lot of thinking in this.
Is that at home that you're doing that in, like, your own, you know, kind of home office, your own coffee, kind of like some quiet time to yourself?
Yeah. Because we are an academic unit. We are a research unit, which means that we're trying to get it right. And that requires thought, and it requires a
deep
little
thinking.
Yeah, writing and things like that. So I try and do 2 or 3 hours of that every day. I'll never get it, but that's what I try and do. Most of the rest of the time I'm on Zoom talking to various of our New Metrics people or other credentialing partners that we've got. What are your problems? How can we fix it? What are you bumping up against? And inventing the way that we can make it easier and more productive for them. So that's a lot of my work. Then it is actually, although we're in a university, we are an enterprise unit, which means that we have to make our own money. So it's a business as well. So I spend a bit of time worrying about finances, same as every other leader.
Yep. Every principal too.
Yeah. Yep. And so it's those kinds of things that I do. But the main thing is I love it. And that's what gets me up every morning.
Well, you can certainly see that in your answers for sure. You mentioned earlier, might have been before we hopped on the podcast, can't remember, but I think you said 38 schools at the moment. And so I guess I'm interested in, you know, where's the future for new metrics, and where do you kind of hope it's going to be in the next kind of, you know, 5 to 7 years?
Yeah, well, we've got 38 schools in new metrics, and they're our first movers, and they're our research partnership, and they're fundamental. We've also got 50-plus schools in Big Picture who we do the credentialing with, and in some ways we learn more from them because we learn a lot from them, particularly about credentialing. We've got another 50 schools that are playing with all the materials, and they feed back to us what they like or dislike. So we're learning. The key thing is learning. We're learning, learning, learning. So we're learning from them. We work with the organisations like the SACE Board, which are doing their new learner profile. We do all some of the psychometrics for them, so we learn there. So where sometimes I think, wouldn't it be nice if we knew everything already? But we're on a 100% learning curve all the time. The future, I hope, is that we can just have more and more impact, include more and more people in our community. We call it the Melbourne Assessment Community. This year, in the next 6 months, we're actually going to be developing credentials that our schools can use at years 6, 10 and 12 that actually are a formal attestation of what each student has achieved at that level. Not all our schools are up to that.
That's exciting.
Yeah, we want to have a real go at that, red hot go at that. But I would like to get to the point in Australia and elsewhere where every student has a really rich profile of their strengths and what their capabilities are. And more importantly, they have the profile, but they also have a deep understanding of who they are so that they can thrive more when they leave school and at school. So that's our big hope. And the more schools that can join with us in our community, that's my sort of objective, so that we can get to our big hope.
Yeah, I've always thought it's kind of interesting, that notion that once we finish school and university to some extent as well, that we move from this list of what we're good and not good at, and we've got to display all of those things, to a resume where we only display the things that we're good at or talk about the things that we're good or passionate about. And I kind of think there's a real, you know, it doesn't really line up, and, you know, like I think that goal to show the strengths of students is super exciting.
Yeah. What else can I say?
Now, you know, this episode is part of our, you know, little five arc episode with EduTech for 2023. And so thank you for taking the time to join us in promoting that. But you are, you know, one of the keynotes at the event, you know, big attraction. What can people kind of expect if they come along and see you at EduTech?
Well, I'm not sure, but that I really like always to have one or two things to say that will get people out of their comfort zone. So that will be my aspiration. So if anyone's there at EdTech, come up and tell me whether I got you out of your comfort zone or not.
You've heard the challenge here.
And mainly, I guess, I just want to spread the word about the magnificent work that our first mover schools are doing. They're doing all the heavy lifting. I mean, Luke, you've got me talking about me, but in fact it's the schools who are doing the heavy lifting here. So if I can share some of the things they're doing, I'll be very happy.
Excellent. Now, just before we get to my favourite segment, which is 6 in 60 seconds, I've got a couple of questions about a personal reflection for you. You know, the first one I would say is, you know, like the inspiration that you have in your role, you've talked about having impact, you know, we've talked about it kind of growing over your journey. Where do you look for, you know, inspiration now at this part of your career?
Well, you know, I feel as though I look for inspiration in our first mover schools. I really do. We have every 6 months we have a convening of four or five people from each of the schools, and I always walk away walking on air because I couldn't say the things they say because they're bringing the stories from the day-to-day experience of the kids. And naturally in a university you don't really get that. So I would say that's the core inspiration, and I just carry that into my policy meetings and try and get it into the writing and things like that.
And if I could take that one step further, what do you do for you in terms of your own continuing learning?
I don't know. I think I'm just persistent. I think if I'm not learning, I get bored. So I just move on. I'm a bit of a mover-onerer. You know, I won't necessarily sit in a meeting that I think is not going anywhere. So, yeah, I'm a mover-onerer.
I remember getting some sage advice. I think I was in my second year of my first job, and one of the older senior guys said to me at the time, he's like, if you're ever in a conference or, you know, a workshop and it's boring you and you're not learning anything, just get up and walk out. You've got no time for that.
Yeah, you shouldn't be rude, obviously.
No.
But,
yeah.
I don't do things that I don't find nourishing.
And we love to get out the crystal ball. You know, we've talked about kind of new metrics in the next, you know, 5 years. Any further thoughts on education more broadly? You know, like you talked about the here and the now of where we are at this point in time and the openness, you know, to potential governments for change and things like that. The crystal ball over the next 5 to 10 years, where do you see education moving towards?
I'd have one word, and that is Commonwealth. One of the things we do notice is that there are disparities in the capacity of different schools to be able to move forward on anything. And so I'm not sure whether this is a crystal ball or a hope, but I really would like us to operate more systemically to make sure that every student gets the opportunity that some students currently get. And this is where I hope that the government initiatives in the next couple of years really head for that, because I would like to get back to the system, or get to the system, where every student comes out as a competent, capable person with agency in their own learning, and they're masters of some area that they can feel proud of. I would like that. I don't know if that's a crystal ball prognostication, but it's a hope still.
I like that. Now, as I mentioned, my favourite segment, 6 in 60 seconds, one word or idea. Matt usually starts shrugging his shoulders at about this point because he's not the biggest fan. I generally give people a score out of 10 on how well they can stick to the rules, because usually no one sticks to the rules. So with that, we'll get going. One educational narrative that's been underrated or overrated in the last 5 years?
Competence as a distinct from knowledge.
One thing you're most proud of during your career?
Stuck at it.
The most interesting PD you've ever done?
Australian Institute of Company Directors course on managing organisations.
If you could change one rule or one thing in education, what would it be?
Resourcing policy of schools.
One book worth reading?
Hubert Dreyfus, On the Internet.
And one person we should interview on the podcast?
Viv White, CEO of Big Picture Schools.
That would be fantastic at some point. We'll have to connect after the podcast about connecting us with her. Well, I'm going to give you 10 out of 10. You answered all the questions with the one word or idea, and I think that's the first person that's ever done a 10 out of 10. So well done to you.
Thank you. And I'll tell you what that shows is that if you get the assessment and the criteria right, you get the result you need.
I love it. I couldn't agree more, and I think that's a fitting way to close out today's conversation. So for the audience out there, I hope you've enjoyed our little chat with Sandra. This is normally where I ask Matt for his closing comments, but seeing he's not there today, I've just got me, and I've been busy scribbling down a few notes. But look, you know, for me, I guess it's just super, you know, I guess exciting to see the work that you're doing and the progress that you're having. You know, I've been following it from afar for a couple of years, like I mentioned, you know, at the top of the show, and to see kind of that impact that you're having, you know, right down at the student level, and that's a positive impact, and those, you know, what you mentioned there around the competence and the capability and the connectedness of students, having them have agency and mastery of at least one domain that they're super passionate about, I think is, you know, it's the way forward. And I think, you know, it's great to see, like you described, these groundswells of coming from school up, you know, to, you know, I think it has to kind of come up through those channels. And it would be nice to see that, you know, that approach you discussed, which is like that lightening of the framework which sits around so that principals and smaller areas can understand, you know, what's appropriate for their community and apply that in their context. And I think that's, you know, would be a super exciting step for education in the country as well. And, you know, lastly, I'd say it's just so evident that you love what you do. And I think that's, you know, really rewarding to see, you know, a leader like yourself who's loving what they do on a day-to-day basis. So, look, I mentioned it earlier, but thank you again for giving up your time today to come and have a bit of a chat with us about all things new metrics. And I look forward to kind of seeing you at EduTech in a couple of months' time. If the audience out there wants to connect with you or want to learn more about new metrics or be one of those schools that wants to have a bit of a play around, what should they do?
Just email me. I'm really easy to get. I'm s.milligan@unimelb.edu.au.
Easy to get a hold of. Oh, well, I don't know. But the email address is easy to remember. We'll see about that. But for the audience out there, if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show and please don't forget to share the love and tell a few of your colleagues that they should be listening to Ed Leaders. We need your help to grow the podcast. Word of mouth is how it happens. As I mentioned at the top of the show, if you're not already signed up for the Ed Leaders newsletter, you are missing out. Published every couple of weeks and it's jam-packed with nuggets to level up your school leadership game. Check out edleaders.com.au for more details. As I mentioned, this episode rounds out the five-part series with EduTech. And as you know, you can see Sandra and the Ed Leaders team at EduTech 2023. And don't forget, if you haven't already got your ticket, use special code EDLEADERS30 for 30% off your ticket, where Sandra will challenge you if you go and see her. You can connect with Ed Leaders and both of us on LinkedIn. We'll keep you up to date with all of what we're up to. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next week.
Go well.
That's me doing Matt's voice, by the way.